I'm going to read out of the book of Numbers, particularly most of the chapter. Numbers chapter 11, and we'll just read the first three verses. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and when he heard them, his anger was aroused. The fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So the place was called Taberah, because fire from the Lord had burned among them. You know, the other day I started reading some C.S. Lewis books. Just, I get in that mood. You know, I need the classics. So I started reading The Great Divorce, which incidentally doesn't have anything to do with a marital divorce. It has more to do with a spiritual divorce, a climate of spiritual divorce. And you know, C.S. Lewis, he's one of those authors. He's one of those necessities for our spiritual lives. And I encourage you to read C.S. Lewis. And you haven't, if you haven't ever read anything from C.S. Lewis, you're in for a real treat. He is the author of all of those amazing Chronicle of Narnia stories that Disney produces for the kids. So he's real imaginative and real creative, and at the same time extremely profound and deep. He'll catch your attention. In fact, the latest Narnia saga is going to be out this Christmas, entitled The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and I'm really looking forward to that. In fact, from what I understand, if we can get a group together here in this building of about 100 to 125 people, they'll actually let us host a premiere of that movie here too. So, you know, that'll avoid the long lines and stuff, and we can do it right here. So think about that. I'll make a few calls. I know people who know people that don't know me. So I picked up The Great Divorce the other day, and what it is this is a fantasy story about ghost spirits in hell. And all of these ghost spirits of people in hell get herded onto a bus. You know, every once in a while they're allowed to take a vacation, and they get herded onto a bus, and they're brought to the edge of heaven. And here at the edge of heaven, they're met by angelic beings, sort of like spirit guides. And the angelic beings help them to see their former lives and sort of get to show them their behaviors on earth. And what happens is they're offered a second chance at the afterlife, if they choose to. And what the story suggests is that even in the afterlife, that humans given a second chance, even in the afterlife, to right their wrongs of the past, usually don't do it. They usually don't give in. A repentant spirit is no closer in the afterlife than in the earthly life. So in the book, C.S. Lewis meets a guy in heaven named George MacDonald. And George MacDonald is a real person. In fact, he's a great, great literary genius. In fact, he was C.S. Lewis's literary hero, you know, from the mid-1800s, theologian, poet, pastor, ahead of his time theologically, and he's C.S. Lewis's hero, and it's kind of cool when you think about it. It'd be like if Pastor Dave wrote a book about life in heaven, and his spirit guide was like Thomas Merton or Thomas Keaton or Brother Lawrence or Mother Teresa or something. It's like that's what we do, right? When we think about heaven, we think of all these perfect scenarios with all these perfect people and all this perfect love and all these moments of perfect inspiration culminating down to one particular space and time. That's our imagination of heaven. But in this tale, in heaven, or at least in the fringe of heaven, Lewis and MacDonald, they meet this woman there who's got some issues. And she speaks at a really rapid pace and in a shrill voice. And she's talking to her own angelic host, and she's just complaining the whole time. And nothing feels right for her. Nothing is right, and she's not happy. And so from the moment that they've walked up to her to the moment they leave her, she's talking and complaining and whining the whole time, and the angel can't even get a word in edgewise. And so I'm going to pick up the rest of the story to you. This is where Lewis and MacDonald, his angel companion, have a conversation about this particular woman. And George MacDonald is, you know, he's Scottish, mid-1800, King James voice, or, you know, early English accent. So MacDonald says, "What troubles ye, son?" asked my teacher. Lewis says, "I'm troubled, sir," said I, "because of that unhappy creature. She doesn't seem to me to be the sort of soul that ought to be in danger of damnation. She isn't wicked. She's only a silly old woman who's got into a habit of grumbling and feels like a little kindness and rest and change would do her all right." That is what she once was. That is maybe what she still is. If so, she certainly will be cursed, or she will certainly be cured. But the whole question is whether she is now a grumbler. Well, I should have thought of that. There's no doubt about that. But ye misunderstood me. The question is whether she is a grumbler or only a grumble. If there is a real woman, even the least trace of one, still there inside all that grumbling, it can be brought to life again. If there's one wee spark under all those ashes, we'll blow it till the whole pile is red and clear. But if there's nothing but ashes, we'll not go blowing them until in our own eyes forever. They must be swept up. But how can there be a grumble, or how can there be a grumble without a grumbler? The whole difficulty of understanding hell is that the thing to be understood is so nearly nothing. But ye have had experiences. It brings with a grumbling mood. And you yourself, still distinct from it, perhaps even criticizing it, and yourself in a dark hour may, will, that mood, embrace it. Ye can repent and come out of it again. But there may come a day when you can do that no longer. There will be no you left to criticize the mood, nor even enjoy it, but just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine. So, like C.S. Lewis's many, many works, especially as in regards to spiritual subjects, there's something profound that underlines the whole story. The person who lives in a chronic state of complaining eventually loses himself. They lose their authentic voice, their authentic being, their authentic self. And you know people like this. You know people that you've run into at the office or at school or in the neighborhood who are identified to you and those around as the complainer. So they're no longer mom anymore. They're no longer the office manager. They're no longer the mailman. They're the complainer or the whiner or something else. They've lost their identity. They've lost their personhood because the thing that reminds you the most of them is their complaining and their grumbling. I want you to write something down. We are not created to be complainers. We were created to be worshippers. In the book of Job, Job was complaining to God, and God asked him where he was when the universe was created. In Job 38:7, God asked, "Where were you, Job? Where were you when the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy?" See, worshiping orientates you to the right attitude before God. Worshiping orientates you to the right attitude before God. If only Job could see that completed added absolutely nothing to his life. But worshiping is different. Worshiping adds everything. You ever seen or heard a barbershop quartet perform? And you no doubt notice that the thing that they do before they actually sing is someone will pull out a small harmonica and just play one single note. And they all hum that note, the whole quartet, they hum that note, and they all begin singing. And that one single note sets the whole tone for the song. That one single note orientates them to that one song. It puts them in sync with one another, and then they can all harmonize with each other. And at that point, they're all truly one. They're all truly one, and they're all truly in perfect key. Now, if having an attitude of worship orientates you and puts you in tune with God, then what do you think an attitude of grumbling and complaining puts you in tune with? In Numbers chapter 11, verses 1 through 3, we find this place called Taberah, or Taberah, if you went to Frank's school. If you went to, like, Dallas, you know, conservative. But if you went to a more enlightened school, inspired school, it's Taberah. So, we find this place Taberah, and it means burning. It literally means burning. And like most people who complain, the people of Israel were complaining about what they don't have anymore. And the irony is that the whole time that they're complaining about what they don't have, the thing that they do have is God. So whatever they didn't have, you would think was compensated by the fact that they still had God. And God was so close to them that he could hear their complaints, and it angered him. And again, complaining has a way of establishing our orientation. It's easy to get orientated to negativity, especially to, you know, whatever we don't have or whatever's not there. And of course, you know, nobody ever realizes that they're doing that. And they're saying, why can't I have what I used to have? That's what the children of Israel was saying. Look at verse 4. The ramble with them began to crave other foods. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, if we only had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt, and at no cost. Also the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and garlands. But now we have lost our appetite, and we never see anything but this manna. And the pathetic thing about our complaints is that we have so much that we don't even ever think about. You know, compared to the rest of the world, we live like kings and queens, even compared to most people in our country. In South Orange County, we live in relatively clean cities and clean streets and perfectly manicured parkways and freeways, free of most litter and trash and clean air and clean water. And again, just the fact that we can walk into a Ralph's or an Albertsons and not feel the tension or the pressure that this place might be blown up or targeted. The fact that we came into this room to worship God and we're not looking over our shoulders and wondering if the police are going to break up our meeting is cause to be extremely grateful. Extremely grateful for what we have and what we've been blessed with. What the children of Israel started... What caused the children of Israel to start praying again instead of complaining? That was Taberah. That was the fire. A little fire and a little heat usually is the thing that motivates us to praying. Let's look at verse 10. Moses heard the people of every family wailing, each at the entrance of his tent. The Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. So this is a bad scene, you guys. This is a bad scene because Moses is angry, God is angry, and the people are crying. Verse 18 says, tell the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed. If only we had meat to eat. We were better off in Egypt. Now the Lord will give you meat and you will eat it. You will not eat it for just one day or 2 days or 5 or 10 or 20, but for the whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wailed before him saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? So they sound pretty ungrateful, don't they? Saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? God says, you're so busted. You ever drank milk and your brother and sister made you laugh so hard that it came running out of your nose? Okay, well, that's what's going to happen, but they won't be laughing. The problem with the children of Israel was that they had a bad case of selective memory. And I have met, and I'm sure you have, many abused women who for some reason stay married to their abusive, thoughtless, criminal husbands. You know, because every time they get away from home, all of a sudden they conveniently remember all the good times. And push comes to shove, and the cops are at the house, and the old man is in the corner, handcuffed, and back in the police car. There comes the wife. You know, she comes running out. What are you doing with my husband? You know, get him out of there. Don't treat him like a criminal. And meanwhile, she's bleeding from all the cuts and the bruises and all the danger she was just moments ago, just before the cops arrive. And you say, don't you remember the bruises? Don't you remember the beatings that he did to you? Don't remember all the pain? But they forget. And so Israel had a problem with selective memory. They say, we had all this meat and fish to eat, and at no cost. They forgot there was a cost. There was a cost to all of this. The cost was their freedom. In Egypt, they were slaves. They forgot about the brutal labor that the Pharaoh had put them on. All that brutal labor, building the Pharaoh's cities and temples and tombs. They forgot about that. And when we complain, we surrender a part of our lives that we cannot control. We cannot control all of our circumstances, and we often stand helpless in the face of the things that happen to us. But this is what we can choose. We can choose the mental environment in which we live. This is our control. My mental attitude, my mental environment can either be a positive one or a negative one. I cannot make traffic go any faster than it's going. I've tried. I have mentally willed the traffic to get moving. And it just doesn't happen. But what can I control? I can control my mood. That is the environment to control. If you choose to complain, you're choosing to surrender the control to the forces of your circumstances. And if we live there, if we choose to live there, if we choose to live in complaints, then eventually everything that we see around our lives are more reasons to complain. That's why we lose our authentic self and our authentic voice. Let me tell you how hard it is to love and worship God when everything around you you think is horrible. And you can choose right now to be a worshiper or a complainer. C.S. Lewis writes, all created things praise, love, glorify, and adore God by rejoicing over their existence and enjoying their life before God. Psalm 145:10, all thy works shall praise thee, O Lord, and all thy saints shall bless thee. Psalm 96:12, let the fields be jubilant and everything in them. Then all the trees of the forest will sing for joy. Psalm 119, the heavens declare the glory of God. God interpreted the children of Israel's complaining as a rejection of him. He assumed that all their complaining was because they didn't want him or they didn't feel that he was adequate to be their God. Verse 20 says, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and have wailed before him, saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? Remember when you were first married? And back then, all you really needed was each other, right? You didn't need any furniture because, you know, a couple of milk crates usually did the trick. And you didn't complain about that because you were in love. You didn't complain about what you didn't have because what you did have was each other, and that was enough. Later on in the prophet Jeremiah, God is going to say to Israel, oh, I remember our early days when you went out with me into a wilderness in a land not sown. See, how will God eventually remember Israel? Will he remember them as a complaining nation? No, he doesn't. He remembers them as a nation who left a land of paradise to be with him in a land of the desert. Because all you really needed was him. What is a Jewish woman's favorite wine? When are you going to take me to Florida? Okay, it's a tough crowd. We cannot make God happy by saying, I wish I was in Egypt. I wish I was in Florida. And therefore, we can't be true worshipers if our hearts are somewhere else. And if our hearts are somewhere else and not in the present, in this present moment, and in this present moment where we feel grateful for what things that we do have. This is the month we celebrate Thanksgiving, and I hadn't entirely planned on doing a Thanksgiving message, but I thought it was appropriate. I pretty much think it's hypocritical if during Thanksgiving we're not actually practicing gratitude or the spirit of thankfulness at all times. So what I've done for myself, which is what I try to do every November, and it doesn't always work, and this November I'm off to a slower start, but I'm inviting you into a proclamation that I have made for myself. I'm inviting you into this, that I suggest for the whole month of November that we do our best to not complain. Really? Give it a try. And we try to remove negative words from our vocabulary. Words like hate and lousy and scumbag and, you know. You know. Especially words that affect negatively somebody else. Now, if choosing to omit those words from your vocabulary or your daily conversation leaves you with empty space and a void to fill, then I suggest using alternative words, praise words. Praise opens doors. Complaining closes them. We remember that we enter God's gates with thanksgiving in our heart, and we enter his courts with praise. So praise creates opportunities. Complaining creates problems. And praise energizes us, but complaining exhausts us. And praise sees the bigger picture, and complaining is myopic. And praise strengthens our relationship with God, and complaining ruins it. Now, we will all one day walk through the shadow of the valley of death. And for some of us, that's already come. I'm thinking about this family that Daryl's been talking to us about, this poor father who's lost his 2-year-old child. I mean, that is the valley of the shadow of death. I'm thinking of Vernon Porter, who lost his daughter last spring. That is living in the valley of the shadow of death. And so I am not here to suggest to you that, you know, under these worst case, hard scenarios, circumstances, that you just turn that frown upside down. That is not at all what I'm saying. And sometimes things are hard and they suck. And it's worth the grief. But if we can just keep our eyes sort of focused on him and remember the whole time he is with us, like he was with Israel in the wilderness. Because in the valley of the shadow of death, we are there. We are in the wilderness. If we can orientate our worship towards him and him alone, then we can fulfill what the psalmist was trying to sing about in Psalm 30:11. When he's saying, you've turned my wailing into dancing, and you removed my sackcloth and clothed me with joy, that my heart may sing and not be silent. O Lord my God, I will give you thanks forevermore. Can you imagine a life completely void of thankfulness, of gratitude, instead a life full of complaining and whining and grumbling. I can't. But in some cases, I realize that if I don't stop now, that could very well be my life. And at some place, something has to ring in your head and your heart and realize this is the choice I can make right now. You don't have to live in the valley of the shadow of death. We can work our way around those burial plots. We can see ourselves through the other side. It begins with the attitude of gratitude. It begins with the mindset of praise, an orientation focused on God and not on our circumstances. Let's stand, would you?